Welcome back to Beat Seeker. I'm your host, Matt McButter. In each episode, we explore the shifting world of music with world-renowned experts and artists to take you deep, deep inside the fascinating and changing world of music technology and music discovery.
And I'm your host, Mike Weider, reminding you to subscribe in Apple Podcasts and give us a five-star rating if you like the episode. You can visit our website at beatseeker.fm, where you'll find plenty of rabbit holes with extra content to dive into, guest backgrounds, and even a playlist with music recommendations from each of our guest episodes. Also, BeatSeeker swag. You can stay current and talk to us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at BeatSeekerPod. Biology would teach us that animal noises are purely functional. The sounds that they make for attracting mates or warning of danger are evolutionary adaptations necessary before surviving in the wild, but nothing more. Our guest today contends the story is more complex than what you learned in bio class. Animals can make music, and it's even possible to jam with them.
To help us sort out this musical jungle is David Rothenberg, a professor of philosophy and music at the New Jersey Institute of Technology, with a special interest in animal sounds as music. He's also a composer and jazz musician whose books and recordings reflect a longtime interest in understanding other species, such as singing insects, birds, and even whales. Through Rothenberg's study of animal song and his experimental interactions with animal music, he's often called an interspecies musician. We reached him in Cold Spring, New York. David, thanks for joining us on Beat Seeker.
Thanks for inviting me.
Well, we're really excited to talk to you today because you have built a absolutely fascinating career studying the music of nature and even performing music with animals, ranging from birds to bugs to whales. And I understand your work playing music with animals started over 20 years ago after a friend invited you to come and play at an aviary in Pittsburgh. Can you tell us that story? Yeah, can you tell us that story and like maybe what the aha moment was for you, if there was one?
Yeah, I would go a little further back. I first learned that it was possibility to connect music to nature when I was a teenager, and I heard about this guy Paul Winter, this jazz musician who played with wolves and whales, and he actually lived pretty close to me in Connecticut, so I got to meet him, and I thought, he's doing some fun things, I should join his band. And everyone in the band said, you do not want to join this band. So I never joined the band, but we became close friends over the many years.
He was kind of a lone wolf.
Oh, no, he had a whole consort, the Winter Consort. It goes on to this day. It's like a world in itself. And now he's in his 80s. He's still doing this. And now we've become good friends over our parallel careers. So he's one big inspiration. At the same time, a Canadian composer was a big inspiration, R. Murray Schafer, who passed away last year. This guy is a composer and then kind of musical activist. You should certainly interview people associated with him. And for his 60th birthday, a big conference happened in Banff in Alberta. I went to that. That was in 1993. And there I realized there was like a small but dedicated group of people around the world interested in this. Like, oh, there were people doing this. And one of the people there was Michael Pestel, who at the time was an art professor at Chatham College in Pittsburgh. And he said, you know, you have to come to this aviary we have. It's actually the National Aviary of the United States in Pittsburgh. Most Americans don't even know there is a National Aviary. And he said, you got to come there and play with the birds. And so I was initially kind of skeptical. Like, I thought that, like, birds are here, people are there, and, like, why do we need to get too close to them? They're doing their stuff, I'm doing my stuff. Even though I like music and nature idea, I didn't think that playing live with birds in a zoo was going to be so interesting. But at that moment, one moment, we were there before it opened, like 6 a.m. walking around. And although most of the birds had no interest in what we were doing, this one bird, a white-crested laughing thrush, really just started singing along with what I was playing. And that was an aha moment. I said, this actually could be interesting. What's really going on here?
That is fascinating. And you know, maybe just to set the stage for this a little bit, in your book, Why Birds Sing, and an earlier book of yours, you wrote, if a lion could talk, we could not understand him. But if a lion roars, we do understand them. If the voice of an animal is not heard as a message, but as art, interesting things start to happen. Nature is no longer an alien enigma, but instead something immediately beautiful, an exuberant opus with room for us to join in. Can you expand on this and explain what you meant by this?
Yeah, thanks for reading that so well. Of course, the phrase, if a lion could talk, we would not understand him, comes from Ludwig Wittgenstein, the famous philosopher. That's what Wittgenstein said. But, you know, we all understand lions, like even Mel Brooks, mm-hmm. you know, 2,000-year-old man. Do you know that?
It rings a bell.
This is the first music, says Mel Brooks, you know, a lion is eating my head off. Somebody call. I'm sure that Mel Brooks also had read Wittgenstein and was thinking about that. So we all heard the 2,000-year-old man when we were little kids, but I was thinking like, come on, we understand animals. Animals understand us. But I was taking in this other direction that if all this stuff is music, it's instantly comprehensible. Like you could play music, and many of us too, and we have absolutely no idea what's going on. Like you don't have to know what you're playing to play something that makes sense. You do it. And most musicians feel like when you go beyond what you think you know how to do, that's when it gets interesting. And these are my favorite quotes and views about music that you find. Like there's a documentary about Joe Zawinul, keyboardist, Weather Report. You know, he says, I press this button on my computer and the low notes are high and the high notes are low. So then when I play, I have absolutely no idea what's going on. And he likes that. Or in one of his bandmates, Wayne Shorter, years later, there's a film about him where they interviewed Danilo Perez. He just joined the band. He's totally nervous. He's practicing every possible Wayne Shorter tune. And he says, okay, maestro, any particular selection you want to begin with today? I'm ready. I practiced everything. Then Wayne Shorter says, no, Danilo, please put the music away. You cannot rehearse for the unknown.
Awesome.
These examples don't have to do with nature and music, but you know, there's this thing about music, especially if it involves improvisation, but many kinds of music, you're doing things you can't quite explain. And so if I say, oh, these animals are talking, we must decipher their language. We don't know their language. It's hard. Let's try and decode it. But if it's music, it's like, okay, we're making music. We get together and we collaborate. Just like you sit down with musicians. You could sit down with a musician from New Guinea. He doesn't speak your language, any language you speak. Start making music. Probably would make sense pretty soon. And this is when I realized you could do that with these birds in the aviary. It's like, okay, this could be interesting. And that's why it's always been important to me to want to join in. You don't just document the natural world. You find a way to join in, which, you know, not everybody likes. A lot of people documenting the sounds of nature. They say, Rothenberg, he's just always putting himself there. He doesn't care about these animals. He's always making noise. Like he doesn't listen. You know, he's just putting himself in the middle of it all. So, you know, but I have some answers for that.
Yeah. So we want to get into the playing with animals part, but maybe before we do, I wanted to ask you just about the science side of things. So, you know, our science would tell us that animal noises are purely functional. They're to defend territory or attract mates. You know, what evidence have you collected in your experience making music with them that would explain that there's more to it than the purely evolutionary functional requirements?
Yeah. So when I wrote this book, Why Birds Sing, you know, I started reading all this science. You know, I want to be a scientist once, so I know how to read these things. And they're actually not that hard. It's much easier to read scientific papers than you think. Like, they're supposed to be clear. This is the summary. This is what we concluded. This is how we got there. And I started to realize that they were missing out on so much stuff. Like, they stopped asking interesting questions, like, you know, what is bird song for? Okay, the male birds mostly are singing. You have to defend a territory, attract a potential mate. End of story. That's what birds are singing about. How come the songs then are so different from each other when the birds' lives might not be so different? Like, why does a chickadee go doo doo and that's its song, and the mockingbird has to sing for hours all these different phrases? It's doing the same thing, defending its territory, trying to attract a mate. Why does the song need to be so complicated? It does not need to be like that. It evolved to be that way because the side of evolution is not about practicality. It's also about craziness, weird things. And Darwin recognized this well. That's why he came up with the theory of sexual selection. And he wrote in The Descent of Man, birds have a natural aesthetic sense. That's why they appreciate beauty. That's why they've evolved all these beautiful songs. And so you say, like, does this mean bird song is not for attracting mates and defending territory? Sure it is. It's just that that doesn't tell you much about the song itself. You can say the same about human music. Look at this guy with his electric guitars on stage. He's just hoping like hundreds of girls are going to be excited.
Defending his territory, attracting mates.
Maybe they are. There might be a lot who'd be excited, but they're also, he might naively, the guitarist believes his music might be about something else besides that. You know, like you could probably get these girls without playing the music. It's not like it's necessary. Interested in something else, the music itself. There is a music itself there. And anyone would tell you, look, I practice, I learn these things, you know. And the same for birds. They learn these songs. They have to sing them just the right way. So this actual musicality of what the birds, it turned out that wasn't studied that much by scientists. Maybe they didn't think it was worth asking, or they didn't know how to study this stuff because it was musical questions rather than functional questions.
And now I'm curious to know how biologists react to your thesis here. And, you know, when they read your work and you interact with them, do they accept your thesis, or do they push back and retreat back to their, again, pure functional view of nature?
Some scientists said, look, why are you writing so critically about us? We have enough problems. Come on. People don't trust science as it is. You know, with the creationists, and then, you know, people like thinking we're wasting our time on pointless projects. Give us a break. But, you know, some scientists said, you're right. Why don't we look at your questions? Come work with us in the lab. And I spent years working in this lab with Ofer Chernikovsky and his students at Hunter College in New York City. And we're still working on projects. The latest one is this long paper about the Song of the Mockingbird with two scientists and me together. We demonstrated that the mockingbird is not copying the songs of other birds. He's composing the song following very specific musical rules that anybody who listens to this bird can identify, but no one had ever articulated it, described it, and then did enough statistical research to connect, to convince scientists that this was really going on. You know, and so we did this. Wow. It took one computational neuroscientist, one field biologist, and me. And it was really fun. It was like over the pandemic, like lots of discussions. And then this is published recently, Mockingbird Morphing Music, it's called. You can look it up. And so the fact is that, you know, some scientists said, you know, we don't need uninformed people like yourself to criticizing us. Others said, yeah, you raise an interesting point. You know, this is how science works, the critique. Let's go do it. And it's hard. It's easier to play music with birds and do birdsong science, for the simple reason that art and science have different criteria for truth. Like I can make, go play with a laughing thrush, do it once and feel like something interesting happened. Like, this was interesting. Here it is. Listen to it. Thousands of people have listened to and watched that video of me playing with his laughing thrush. It's kind of fun. But what's really going on? I couldn't say objectively without doing it hundreds of times and looking at the data and analyzing, does the bird respond, et cetera. I'm only mildly interested in that kind of work, but it's worth doing.
Right. They're looking for controlled experiments that have repeatability and pure objective
criteria. You can't
just say,
this is cool as the answer. You have to statistically demonstrate 80% of the time this happened.
I get it.
You know, and that's why science is both trusted and frustrating at the same time.
Right. And I understand, in one of your books, you write about an encounter with a biologist in a park in Berlin who wasn't so happy with you stepping on their turf. Can you tell us that story?
Yeah, with Silke Kipper, you know, she said, like, what are you doing here? I told you not to be in my territory. This is where we study the birds. We're doing control experiments on them. You've ruined our birds here. And I said, okay. But, you know, recently, this year, she wrote her own book, which very interestingly describes the same encounter and describes herself in totally different terms. And the book has like cool cartoon illustrations of her as this kind of punk scientist wandering through the forest, which is not really the way she is. But, you know, and she also, she says very nice things about me in that encounter, you know, and it should be noted in my book. I also say, like, she's right. Why don't I go do it somewhere else? You know, there's enough nightingales around. They're doing amazing work there. And so, yes, I don't go back to that site anymore. So they can study those birds. But then again, these birds are in Berlin. They're interested in all kinds of sounds. There's endless parties at that particular park all the time. If you want pristine birds, you're not going to find them there. But the fact is something that scientists are now beginning to realize, birds are interested in all kinds of sounds, not just the sounds of their own species. like the evolution of this field is becoming more ecological. Let's listen to it all, figure out what's going on. And that's changing the whole discourse.
David, I'd like to bring us back to your jam sessions with animals. You know, you sort of talked about some of the origins. And when you first started playing with animals, what were your expectations? Did you expect them to react to you or
no,
to
I expected them not to be interested. Yeah. I had no expectations. It was this laughing thrush moment that got me interested.
Okay. And so that was you'd say that was kind of the encounter that made it clear that the animal was playing with you. Yeah.
And then the more that I'm doing it, I realized that there's always something interesting that happens, very surprising things. Mm-hmm. And every time I feel like I should just go out doing more of this. Like, why am I sitting at the computer today watching the leaves fall? Like, I should just be outside.
And what was it about that encounter or encounters that you've had that has made it clear to you that the animal is really, you know, playing with you and not just some kind of coincidence in the mind or some other kind of synchronicity where your music and their music is harmonizing? Like what?
Oh, it all might be coincidence. I'm not doing any science on this, but I do think that animals listen. You know, why would you assume it's coincidental when somebody makes a sound, someone else makes a sound? You know, the kind of null hypothesis, as Richard Crumb might say, is that they are responding. Why assume otherwise? Because they respond to sounds. You go outside, the birds make noise, you know, for different reasons. And they tend not to ignore. They're sonically attentive beings. They pay attention to what's around. So what surprised me is that this one bird was particularly interested and most were not. Like, okay, what is it about laughing thrushes? I had no idea. I was just playing with him. Then later I read up on them. I thought, like, it's a male bird. He's defending his territory. He's mad at me. You know, he's aggressive. But in fact, no. The white-crested laughing thrushes, the males and females, both make sounds, and they listen to each other, kind of, and they sing back and forth. So actually what they're doing is more like a duetting call than a song. I had no idea that what was going on. But when I did it, I realized this bird has an interactive notion of sound. And I talked to the one professor, Frederick Venkel, who wrote on this bird. Surprising, because the bird is so common in Asia and Southeast Asia and South Asia. Very little research is done on this bird, probably because they're so common. And who knows? Like most creatures,
nobody thought they
were
interesting.
We haven't studied. Almost everything is unstudied. The white-crested laughing thrush is like the blue jay. Blue jays talk to each other. They have about 50 different sounds. No one has studied this. It's like they're too common. Ravens, despite all the study on ravens, say by Bernd Heinrich, he's written literally 10 books on ravens. He even said, like, I don't know what they're talking about. I don't know what the sounds are. How can you say that? Like, you raised them in your house. These birds have lived in your house with you. He goes, I don't know. And so, but he's a pretty impressive guy. So it just shows that even a lot of time spent with other creatures, we just don't really know what's happening. And that kind of interests me. I don't know who's responding to what, but together I feel like we make often this interspecies music is made, a music no one species could make alone. Like something's happening. And it goes from birds to whales to even my current obsession with underwater pond creatures. Like, you know, these creatures underwater, we never know who's making what sound. Some are plants, some are animals. You definitely hear it responding to the sounds that are happening above the water. Once you have the hydrophone in and the speakers, like nobody would say otherwise. And boy, this is like, you know, there's some connection here. But I wouldn't say I know what kind of causal connection is there. But when you listen, you kind of, you know, you learn, you hear like the interconnectedness between things. You create the meaning in a way. And so sometimes you can point out very definite things. But
and so would you say, I mean, some species or some different types of animals react more to the music and kind of jam more readily than others? I mean, that seems...
I feel the same way often playing with humans. Like, this guitarist is not listening to me. If I wasn't here, he'd be playing the same thing. You know? It happens all the time. And some people, to surprise you, they pay attention. So
how many different types of animals have you tried to play with?
Well, sometimes you're playing with whole environments. You don't know. There could be like 50 different species of bird at dawn, and they're all there, and you're trying to do something with the whole ecology of sound. So many. I'd say the individuals I spent time with, we started with particular birds, like the laughing thrush is a big part of why birds sing. The lyrebird in Australia is, I talk about playing with nightingales and mockingbirds in that book. I don't actually do it until years later. And afterwards, I went to play with whales. Next book was called Thousand Mile Song. That book is out of print. A new edition is coming this year under the name Whale Music. It's in about a month, it'll be out. And that one I played with humpback whales, beluga whales, and killer whales to travel around the world to do this. Humpbacks are the most interesting, I would say. But belugas are very engaging. They really pay attention to you. They're just like, okay, they're following you around. But they might all be talking. The way they use sound is more social. Never underestimate a beluga whale, I think. You know, they're doing all kinds
That's
of
a good attitude.
Stuff. You know, people doing experiments with them say, don't bother. They just figure out what you're doing and do something else. You don't just play a sound for it and see how it responds. They go like, that's not interesting. They go off somewhere else. Anyway, I'm still going down the list. Yeah. Afterwards, I got very interested in 17-year cicadas. I said that, you know, okay, every 17 years they come out. I remember this. When I was 17, the first time, that means I was born. When I was born, the cicadas came out. 17 years later, 34, 51, each time. They're always coming out somewhere, so you can find them other places. So that's why I did that project. And here you have this wash of sound that just appears for a few weeks, then it goes away. Wait 17 more years, they're back. That seemed like this fascinating rhythm in the animal world. And in that process, we also had other creatures like crickets and, you know, katydids.
Crickets,
insects.
Yeah.
Insects seems like the source of our interest in noise as music. They're just so, the insect world is full of cool sounds. And then they had this nightingale project. I was going to move to Berlin for a year and play music with nightingales that also came out for a few weeks every year. They're singing. So since I did that, 2014, most years in spring, I go back to Berlin to play with these birds. Yeah, and so this is this trajectory. And lately, the next project is about underwater pond sounds. You know, again, I'd always heard that in ponds, there was all these great sounds, but I never, when I put a hydrophone in the water, the ones used for whales, it never would work. I never heard anything. And then I saw this sound installation upstate, like an hour north of here, and they were hearing all kinds of great sounds. And I learned you need to have a different kind of hydrophone, which this artist in Brooklyn had made. But until he made me a few of them, and then I decided I wanted more. So then I made a few hundred of them in China and started selling them because it seemed like it was hard to find a good pond hydrophone. And
that's
your side hustle.
It's actually better. It's better than selling music. The hydrophones have funded a lot of other things I've done because lots of people wanted these things. And so there's still some left of the first round before I have to make more. But people, you know, because there are ponds everywhere. It's so easy to find the strange sounds. And you can just like stick a hydrophone in the pond and a lot of people record them. They're putting on headphones, but I like to put a speaker out and then you play the pond sounds above the water and you see hear how all the other creatures respond to what's underwater. Like frogs and tree frogs say, what's this? You know, they start singing along, crickets and birds. And if you sit there for hours, very weird things will happen. You'll hear sounds probably no one knows what they are. Like literally, we don't know. And certain ponds are full of surprises.
So have you made some installations where it's just playing in a park or something like that where people can walk by and experience this?
Yeah, I have done some things like that, different ones. Different ones and in science museums and things like that. And I've thought about how to do more of those. And the pond book maybe comes out a year from now or so. And I'm going to have so much pond music now. I'm sifting through it. Which ones do I want to use? And also it was very much like a pandemic project. You sit home, go in the woods, record the ponds, and then sit online with somebody halfway around the world. Like you sit, do something with this and see what words come out. And you mail this weird, very strange.
That's
things.
Amazing.
Now the book is like trying, it's very different than the other books. There's not so much science in it, but it's more like about not being able to go anywhere. And then
Mm-hmm. You connect to the world through these sounds.
And so how has playing with animals influenced or changed you as a musician?
Yeah, you get.
I almost said magician there.
Good question. Yes. Yeah, my good friend David Abram, who's a philosopher and magician, he says, like, you know, what's magical about all this is the fact that we can perceive. Like, perception is the magic. The fact we can hear things, the fact we can visualize, understand the world through our sensory abilities. That's magic right there, and that's how magic mm-hmm. works, of course. And so. Yeah, I think I've always been interested in some different kind of inspiration than I expect, like some different rhythms. I always, as a young jazz musician, liked things that were in 7 and 5 and 11 and other rhythms. And how come from this part of the world they do this? How come in Ethiopia, tritones, like consonants, they're just playing like C and F sharp for hours? Boom, 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 you know, how does that work? So I was always interested in something else rather than what's expected in a way, instantly unpopular. And so in finding, I'm interested in not just interested in playing music with birds and bugs just because it's weird. I just like the sounds. I think it's interesting ideas that come from there. And there's something like necessary about their music, like it's been around for millions of years. That should count for something. We know that it works. Well, humans are constantly changing their mind. I was doing a panel with like some famous classical musicians who play like nature-based music, like Pierre Laurent Aimard. He's a Messian interpreter. And people are asking, so David, do you really think animals make music? And I said, well, I know they make music. I'm not sure humans make music because we can't make up our minds about anything. Like we like this one day, then we don't like it. And, you know, we like, but they know, they've been doing it for a long time. Like their music is established and clear. But we are a species constantly changing our mind about everything. So we are.
They don't have different genres that they're into.
They know what they're doing. You know, they know. The 17-year cicada does not come out every 18 years. It's counting 17 years.
Yeah,
someone might
absolutely
say, come on,
incredible.
18 is cool. They say, I don't care. I'm coming out.
So David, you know, over 50 years ago, I guess Roger Payne was an early pioneer in bioacoustics and put out this album, Humpback Whale Songs. It became a huge hit and kickstarted a movement to save them. Why do you think people reacted that way? Was it just that the album brought attention to the whales, or was that a recognition that these animals were intelligent or musically capable that made people, I guess, connect with them in a different way?
Yeah, I mean, the reason it was so popular is the sounds were so beautiful. People just loved the sound. It was the sound that got people interested. People couldn't believe whales were doing this. Like, imagine not knowing that. Because you read in Moby Dick, the whales are silent. The huge, giant, silent beings. But you find out they're making sound. Like, this is amazing. This is like a real discovery.
And you needed a hydrophone back then.
You need a hydrophone. But actually, the mystery, and this is, I know I have a good answer to this question. If you dive in Hawaii where there's so many humpback whales, you can definitely hear them underwater with your own ears. Did nobody notice this? Why did nobody talk about this? I have no good answer for that question. It may have to do something with, like, we listen for what we expect to listen for.
Right.
I mean, more has been said about that, but basically you have to wonder. I asked people who were diving in the 50s in Hawaii, like, did you hear whales? No. Do you hear whales today? Yeah.
Do you think they didn't know that it was just ambient and they weren't aware?
There's different views about this. One might be there weren't so many whales because we were hunting them. They stayed away. That's one idea, but that can't be true everywhere. The other idea is you didn't think there was anything down there. Didn't try to listen. The other idea is people knew they didn't want to talk about it. They thought it was some weird sound. Odysseus hearing the sirens in the Mediterranean. Some people think that was whales resonating with the boat because you can hear it resonating with boats. But there's not a good answer to that question. There's almost all the accounts of whalers say the whales are silent. There is one that says everyone knows humpback sing. So go figure. There's one whaling memoir that says that. So go figure. Only one says that.
This is a fascinating discussion. We could carry, I could talk about this stuff all day, but we're
going to
have to
go deep into the whale mysteries. People will say anything whatsoever. Those guys are still around, Roger Payne and Scott McVeigh. I saw Roger Payne joining a big whale conference online like 2 or 3 weeks ago.
Oh, that's awesome.
I hear from Scott McVeigh all the time. He's also an important person getting me into all this. He's the co-discoverer of the structure of the humpback whale song. And his daughter was a friend of mine in college. And so then I got to know him before I started doing all this. And then over the years, I've talked to him many times about this and such.
Amazing. Amazing.
A legend.
So, David, we like to ask our guests if they have a music recommendation. We've got a guest picks playlist. Can you give us something that we could put on our playlist?
Like just one thing. You want one piece?
One piece.
Well, I just did a concert with Cosmo Sheldrake. He's the son of Rupert Sheldrake, famous like alternative scientist, and he's the brother of Merlin Sheldrake, who wrote a popular mushroom book. So Cosmo is cutting and pasting animal sounds together, and you know he's got millions of people listening to this stuff. So he's like an alternative English folk rock pop star making nature music.
I love it. I love it. We'll seek that out.
I just sent him some whale songs right now. I go, I need some whale songs.
Yeah.
And he always makes sure that some of the royalties go to the animals directly.
Oh, that's cool.
It's always nice to see people who actually have millions of streams on Spotify for weird nature sound music. Like, how does this happen? I have no idea.
Very interesting. Okay. And lastly, David, if our listeners want to follow you or your work, where's the best place for them to go?
Oh, you know, I'm on various platforms. I don't use it all the time, but I post more on Facebook than on Instagram or Twitter. But look for my whale music book. It's about to come out. And I'm putting out a new album of more weird music based on whale sounds. And the pond book comes next year.
David, thanks so much for being on the show today. It was a fascinating conversation.
Thanks so much for inviting me.
You've been listening to Beat Seeker with your hosts, Matt McButter and Mike Wider. If you like the show, go to Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts and hit the subscribe button. While you're there, leave us a rating and a comment and share it with your friends and colleagues. If you want to dig deeper into this content, visit beatseeker.fm. That's beatseeker.fm. And if you want to be part of the show, check out our Patreon link. Interact with us on social media at BeatSeekerPod. BeatSeeker is recorded in the Devil Lake Studios and the Tunnel Under Arundel. The show is produced by Matt McButter, Mike Wider, and Kate McCartney. Tim Ratledge is our editor. Thanks for tuning in and keep seeking.